Before becoming a science correspondent for NPR, Joe Palca earned a PhD in psychology, worked as a sleep researcher, and wrote about science in a national publication. Since 1992, he's been telling millions of public radio listeners about the latest developments in science.
On the Juno spacecraft to Jupiter, there's something called JunoCam, which is actually a camera that was supposed to go on a Mars mission, and they decided they weren't going to put it on the Mars mission, so they stuck it on Juno. And the public will be able to vote on what to take a picture of.
On this week's Eastern Standard, NPR science correspondent Joe Palca recorded during the 2016 WEKU Day Sponsor event in Lexington. We're unable to take any listener calls or emails for response during this show, but we are still always glad to hear from you at WEKUEasternStandard@gmail.com. Follow the show on Twitter at WEKUEST. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR. From the Lyric Theater in Lexington, Kentucky, through the facilities of WEKU Public Radio, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. Joe Palca is a science correspondent for NPR. Since joining NPR in 1992, Joe has covered topics as diverse as biomedical research, astronomy, and basic physics. Before becoming a science journalist, Joe spent several years as a sleep researcher and earned a PhD in psychology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's currently focused on the eponymous series Joe's Big Idea. Stories in the series focus on the minds and motivations of scientists and inventors in order to present science not as a set of discoveries, but as a process of understanding. And Joe joins us for the WEKU production during the WEKU Day Sponsor event in May of 2016. Joe, thank you for being with us.
It's great to be here.
Joe, let's begin talking a little bit about your career, and we certainly want to get into some science issues, and I know they can be pretty wide-ranging, but a PhD, and then proceeded to get in broadcasting. I suspect that's not a very long list of people in our business with a PhD doing broadcasting.
There are a handful, but it wasn't. I mean, obviously, I didn't start off going into a PhD in physiological psychology, saying, "And when I'm done, I'm going to be a journalist." that wasn't the initial trajectory. But about 4 years into my PhD, I was found myself in a spot that a lot of graduate students wind up in, which is, now what? I had done all my research for my dissertation, and it makes me laugh, but times were tough, and there wasn't a lot of money for biomedical or psychological research in those days, which now turn out to be the good old days, but I guess it's ever thus. And so I was sort of thinking, gosh, Joe, you're going to have to figure out what to do. And I was sitting at my desk in the basement of Clark Kerr Hall and the campus of University of California at Santa Cruz. And you said that, and I mentioned I was in the basement because most people think, how did you ever get a PhD in such a beautiful spot? And I said, well, I was in the basement, so I didn't know it was a beautiful spot. But I saw an ad in Science Magazine for this program that was run by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, called the Mass Media Science and Engineering Fellows Program, and they basically pluck people out of the lab and plop them down into a news organization. And I said I wanted to do a television. I prefer to be in a television station because I detested writing. I found writing to be an complete painful chore, and I figured TV had the least amount of writing. And so they did. They plopped me down, and they CBS affiliate in Washington, D.C., and it's like the first time, the first time you walk into something and you suddenly say to yourself, wow, this is what I got to do for the rest of my professional career. And so after that summer, I'd made up my mind that I was going to leave research for good, but, I didn't want my mother to be disappointed that she didn't have a son, Dr. Palca, so I finished my degree and never looked back.
How did you end up at NPR?
Well, that was a little strange. Winning this fellowship, that was one key moment. Another key moment, I was working in a local television station, and the phone rang, and the editor of Nature called and offered me a job as their Washington correspondent. I mean, you talk about odd transitions. going from graduate school to journalism is one, but going from local television news to Nature is probably a bigger unbelievable, because Nature is this international science journal, and local television news is silly nonsense, excuse me. I didn't say that. So I worked at Nature for a few years, and then I got traded to Science for a future draft pick. Then one day my friend Richard Harris, in those days, you know, there was no internet, so we actually had to go to press conferences. I got to know Richard, who was one of the science correspondents at NPR. And he came to me one day back in, I guess it was probably 92 or might have been 91. NPR is very slow in hiring. He said, my colleague Michael Scholar is going to go off for a year, and we need a one-year replacement for him. And I went and interviewed with Ann Gudenkoff, who's been the editor of the science desk since day one. And she said, well, yeah, it's a one-year job, and I'm afraid we can't match your salary. But it's yours if you want it. And I thought, oh, that's great. Let's see. Take a pay cut and lose job security? Yeah, I'll try that. it wasn't like a dream come true. I didn't start in journalism thinking, oh, someday I'll get to NPR. But I had become attached to NPR over the years. And it was really a situation where at Science, I was like the top reporter. I was number one. I was having a great time. But there was an editor there I didn't really get along with that well. And I was thinking, you know, if he had been a good guy, I probably never would have gone to NPR. So the fact that he annoyed me so much actually helped a lot in my career.
So subject matter was more important to you and journalism more important to you than broadcasting?
Yeah, I was more interested in being a science writer than I... Oh, and by the way, the funny thing is I lost my distaste for writing. I mean, working at Science and Nature, and even before that, I found writing kind of satisfying. What I realized I didn't like was not knowing what I wanted to say. But once I know what I want to say, it's fun to come up with the best way to say it. But I was pretty tickled when I realized NPR was going to be a possibility, and I had this great experience, you know, of walking in the first day, and I'm sure you guys are probably having a little bit of that jarring sense that you've never seen me before. Maybe some of you have looked on the internet, but like I know that voice, but I don't know who that person is. And my first day at NPR was like walking in, and there's somebody who sounds like Cokie Roberts, but shouldn't look like Cokie Roberts. Oh, yeah, that's what Cokie Roberts looks like. It was a hilarious day. Very disconcerting, but very interesting.
In terms of beginning the job, how do you decide what you're going to cover? How did you decide what's next, what's the first story, and how you're going to take off?
Well, it's easy. Your editor says, cover that. And so that was the easy one. The answer to that question has evolved, but I can tell you a little bit about how science news gets covered and how we learn about it. So as I said, there are press conferences. So in Washington, the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation or the National Bureau of Standards, as it used to be called, and now it's Institute of Standards and Technology. These places have something they want to say and they hold a press conference. New England Journal of Medicine, for a long time, was sending out first-class copies of the magazine a week in advance to reporters so that they could see what was in the magazine and prepare a story on whatever was in the magazine. And this has created something called the embargo, where it was actually the editor's name was Engelfinger, and there's something called the Engelfinger rule, which I'll explain to you. But the rule is you get this magazine a week in advance, and you agree not to broadcast anything or write anything until the embargo date lifts. Now, you would think it would be the date of publication. If it comes out on May 5th, then you'd be able to talk about it at 12:01 a.m. May 5th. But it's actually a little subtler than that. New England Journal of Medicine wanted to be sure to capture CBS Evening News. So they made the embargo for 6 p.m. the night before, because the CBS Evening News would be pissed off if they were always coming after the New York Times. And somehow it didn't bother the New York Times so much to be coming after CBS Evening News. I'm just saying CBS because that's where I worked. But so these embargoed journals come at you, and it's basically you look at the... It used to be there was only a handful of them that were available under embargo. Now there are dozens. But it was... We would open the mail, and there would be press releases in the mail, and we'd say, oh, that's interesting. In some cases, we would go to scientific meetings, and the scientific meetings would have press conferences, and they would try and feed us stories. But it's not a scientific process. It's not an academic process. It's much more hit or miss, and so that's how you find out. And after a while, the game is, so we get these articles and we look at them and we say, oh, that's going to be in the New York Times. We better do it, which is a silly reason to put something on the air, but from editor's point of view, it's very important. Because if you don't put it on the air, then the editor comes to you the next day and says, this is in the New York Times, it must be important. Or Associated Press. I've been at events where the AP reporter is there, and I know what's going on, and I know the AP reporter's wrong, not important, but maybe covering the wrong thing, but my editor wants to know why I missed the AP story. Because I'm not the AP. There is no absolute, you must cover this. I mean, there are a few of them, but we were talking. There's just, most of the time, it's make a decision of what you think is interesting or important and do that. But it's idiosyncratic because my judgment is mine and somebody else from the AP and somebody else from the New York Times has his or hers.
Well, as listeners, the folks gathered here with us, and of course, folks listening in are familiar with NPR's sound, rich style of reporting, and also the ability of NPR to reach out and go further in depth than what's being handed to reporters during the press gaggle or the press conferences and so forth. To what extent do you do enterprise reporting, going out, deciding perhaps in editorial meetings, this is a story we're going to pursue, we're going to find out about this, and no one else is working on that story?
Yeah, that's much more common at NPR and much more common for me as I've sort of pulled back from the daily news making problem. And I'm not on the air as much as I used to because I'm given the luxury of more of those kinds of stories. You know, it's funny though, I want to comment on one thing you said about sound rich. A lot of people will come to me with a story and they say, oh, it's got great sound. And, you know, it's got a bang, bang, bang or something happening or a roar or something like that. I'm going, that doesn't make a great story, you know. I tease my editor, my producer we work with a lot at Rebecca Davis, that, you know, that sound is almost irrelevant to radio. It's the story part that you have to get right. Because, you know, there are only a few sounds that are really going to save a really bad story. So you have to get the story right, and you have to tell it in an interesting way. And I remember when I first came to NPR, they had two kinds of tape recorders. One was a Sony, was a cassette recorder, and the other was a Marantz. And the seasoned NPR reporters all had Sonys, and the newbies got Marantzes. And all the people said, oh, poor guy, you got that stupid Marantz tape recorder. It's got a lot of hiss. Right? I worked for 10 years, nobody ever complained about the hiss in my stories. My stories were interesting, and if there were hiss, nobody noticed that part.
We're going to take a short break. We're with Joe Palca, NPR science correspondent. This is taking place at the WEKU Day Sponsor Reception at the Lyric Theater and Arts and Cultural Center in Lexington, and we will be right back. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. And this broadcast taking place at the WEKU Day Sponsor event on May 5th of 2016 at the Lyric Theater in Lexington. And we're talking with Joe Science, we might as well call you Joe Science, Joe Palca, about his beat of science at NPR. For the most part, Joe, most of the reporters at NPR have a beat, a specialty. Is that correct?
Yeah, we definitely, NPR is organized by desk and by show. And so the desks are science and Washington and national and foreign and science and art. And the shows are Morning Edition, All Things Considered. And sometimes the shows ask us to do a particular story, but more often we're generating stories and saying, hey, put this on your show. And sometimes the shows do their own. I mean, they'll get interested in something and they'll make calls and do interviews and do their own science or any other thing. But yeah, the shows, I guess you would say, are the polymaths. I mean, they can dip in anywhere, but the desks tend to focus more on what their expertise is in.
And for the most part, when listeners hear a report from one of the NPR staff reporters, we're hearing from someone who has essentially become embedded in the subject matter, become an expert in that subject matter, as you have in science.
Well, I think yes. I mean, it's not really that we're an expert in the subject matter. It's that we understand how to find the people who are expert and explain what they're talking about. I guess with the political people, I mean, there's a funny symbiosis, it seems, between political reporters and politicians, or political reporters and political wins, let's say, because the reporters are in some way are deciding what the national mood is by what they think it is and reporting it. I have harder data to go with. You know, I have a peer-reviewed journal with data and conclusions and results, and I always, it's always amazing to me that, you know, when the host will get on the line and there'll be somebody in Paris, right, Eleanor Beardsley or someone, and say, how are people in Paris feeling about this? And you go, how the heck is she going to answer that question? It's one person walking around a city of several million. And yet, you're supposed to give an answer to that. But nobody's going to say to me, you know, and they do sometimes, how do scientists feel about this? And I go, how would I know? You know, I can tell you what the science is. So it's especially difficult coming from a scientific background when you get asked a question that you know doesn't have a scientific answer and that you know you have to answer. And so you say, well, you know, scientists, I mean, if I said scientists are upset these days because they don't feel there's enough money for research, I haven't talked to every scientist, but I'm pretty safe ground on that one. But if I say, you know, scientists in general favor embryonic stem cell research, I wouldn't say that. I know the ones who favor it, but I'm sure there are some who don't because they feel it's a morally contentious thing to do. So it's hard, and I try not to characterize what scientists think. I try to talk about what they've discovered or what they've got data to back up.
We're going to ask our members of the audience in attendance at the Lyric Theater to step forward with some questions in just a few moments. We're talking with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Joe, let's talk about Joe's big idea. What Ooh. Is Joe's big idea? We've been hearing a lot of buzz about that these last number of months.
Well, that's good. So Joe's big idea was actually something that I began tinkering with more than a decade ago. And that is, again, I feel that the nature of science and the nature of news sometimes force us to overstate the importance of a particular study. And actually, we often miss what turns out to be the really important study. And I mean, I give an example. Most people have probably heard of graphene, which is the monolayer of carbon atoms that you can get by pulling a scotch tape off of a carbon pencil. And this graphene has all sorts of interesting properties. And as I told you, I get the magazine Science where the first description of graphene appeared. And it won the Nobel Prize in 2010, I think. Yeah, 2010. And the paper describing it was in 2004. And I thought, okay, if there's a paper that's so important that it wins a Nobel Prize within 6 years, I must have covered that. So I went back to look, and of course I didn't, and neither did any other science writer in America that I could find. There were a few specialty journals that have been sort of tracking this. But my point is, we don't know. It was important, but the people who were aware of its importance hadn't brought that to the attention of the news media at that point. But instead, we run around off our other things, and I can't tell you, I did a series once where I, you know, at the end of, you listen, you'll hear it, there's always a sentence in these, new gene for this or product for that, and it said, and this could lead to a new therapy or a new something or other. So I did I went back 10 years and found every instance of, and this could lead to, in stories that I had done. And of course, none of them led to. They all led to more research. Nobody was done studying the subject, but nobody either had come up with the breakthrough treatment or something. And that's okay. I'm not indicting scientists for that. I'm indicting the process by which we impart scientific information as overstating the implications. Because everybody who puts in a grant application has a line in there that says, I'm doing this research because it could cure cancer, or it could help diseases, or inform us in some important fundamental way. But most of the time, it's not going to do that. And we in the media, always, we go straight to that sentence, and that's where we start. And so I had this idea that if you can explain that science and research and that is a process to get answers to complex questions rather than a series of results, then you can tell all these really interesting stories about really interesting people who are doing really interesting stuff without having to say, and this could lead to, and still get it on the air. Excuse me. So that was the idea. Now, the name is kind of funny. I didn't want to call it Joe's Big Idea, but we actually had a chance to suggest to somebody who was interested in a foundation that was interested in funding NPR, and we were trying to come up with a name so that we could tell them this is what Joe's doing and this is what it's going to be called, and we were having a really hard time coming up with a name, and we were having lots of meetings, and one of the people who had come to one too many meeting, and he was sick of them, and he kind of sat down and said, okay, what's up with Joe's Big Idea today? And the name stuck.
And now, is it merely a radio series, or is it expanded into a blog?
Well,
is it all
online
component?
Yeah, so like all news media, we're trying to understand the best way to reach our audience in as many ways as our audience is there. So once upon a time, it was just radio, and then it was radio and a web build-out, and now it's radio and a web build-out and a podcast and a Facebook and a Reddit and everything. So I'm you know, being dragged into this world. I don't quite understand why I'm not an early adopter in social media, but it just didn't turn out to be that way with me. So there's a really, we're doing some crazy things at NPR right now. There's a Facebook page for Joe's Big Idea, and last week, NPR is doing some live broadcasts with Facebook, and so it's NPR Live, and my Facebook page is sort of not getting a ton of hits, you know, maybe 10,000 on a good day, and the day it went from 10,000 to 370,000.
Oh my God!
When I did this live event, so I'm thinking, well, maybe I should do more of those. It's a different format, but yes, it's a floor wax, it's a high speed record, it's everything. But it's Joe's Big Idea in any format that we can think of.
Joe Palca is NPR science correspondent. He's with us at the Lyric Theater in Lexington, Kentucky, as part of WEKU's annual day sponsor event. We invite people who have donated to the station to join us for a reception and an opportunity to participate in an Eastern Standard program. And the callers are not calling in by telephone, but they're here in person. And we will go to our first caller at the microphone here at the Lyric Theater, Karen. Karen Summers, thank you for being with us, Karen.
Yes, this is my third opportunity. I've been here for all three, and anyone that has the opportunity to come and not is missing out. I want to say also thank you to all the WEKU staff, because I know y'all work really hard to put things on the air that I enjoy every day, same with the NPR. Okay, Joe, I am an occupational therapist, and I work with special need kids at Model Lab School on EKU. And in some of my graduate studies with Doris Pierce, she has been talking about sleep for years and how important sleep is. And when you said you were a sleep researcher, my my synapses in my brain started going off. So I'd love for you to talk a little about sleep and how important it is and how we don't value enough in our society, especially for kids with ADD, et cetera, anything like that.
Well, thank you, Karen.
Thanks. as I said, so my PhD was handed to me by the University of California system in 1982. And I'm hoping that there's been a few advances in sleep research since then. But reaching back into the PALCA archives of my brain, my synapses, I will say that there was a guy named Bill Dement who was one of the great sleep researchers, is still, I guess, although he slowed down a bit. And he was very concerned about sleep hygiene from the get-go. And I think the morbidity, in other words, the illness that's caused by drowsiness, I was hearing just the other day, somebody was comparing it to texting, that there are as many accidents on the highway just because people are drowsy. Now, drowsy can sometimes be because you don't take care of yourself in sleeping, or it could be that you have a sleep disorder, such as apnea, which is waking you up, and one of the symptoms is excessive daytime sleepiness. But I think, this is, again, this goes back to me having adopted something that was true 40 years ago or 30 years ago, and I hope it's still true because I believe it. But I do believe that it's important to try to get your sleep into a regular pattern, because when you're shifting your sleep patterns, like Bob Edwards, who the host of Morning Edition, was always sleep deprived, because he tried to go back to a normal pattern on the weekend, and then on the weekdays he'd come in at 2 or 3 in the morning. I mean, I'm sure Steve Inskeep now and David Green. Shift work is just miserably hard on the body. And I actually got involved in this a little bit in the Mars story, because Mars has a 25-hour day almost. And so the Mars people said, well, that's great. We get an extra hour, you know, of sleep. That's fine the first night and the second night. But if you're living in a 24-hour world on Earth and trying to live on a 25-hour clock, it's deadly.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations, and we are at the Lyric Theater in Lexington with an audience of folks who have contributed to WEKU for the annual WEKU Day Sponsor reception and the taping of an Eastern Standard program with NPR science correspondent Joe Palka. And up to the microphone is Martha Peterson. Martha, thank you for being here.
Thank you. I am a scientist, and I'm very interested in, of course, my own research. I'm interested in a broad range of research as well. So I love reading broad areas of science, but and I like to try to explain it to non-scientists, but it's hard. And I was just wondering if you, over the years, have come up with some sort of a process. I mean, as you talk to the experts, you have to sort of distill lots of details down into a story that you can make understandable to a broad range of people. And do you have a process for doing that?
Sort of. The process is, first off, to stop being a scientist. I say that because scientists are used to talking to other scientists who listen to them with acute attention, sometimes in a friendly manner, sometimes waiting for them to make a misstatement or a misstep so that they can pounce. So it's very hard to realize that you're suddenly completely out of that world and that the people who might notice some flaw in your, you know, without mentioning the pH of the buffer that you were using to do your experiment, which they know is crucial, but nobody else knows or cares, you know. You have to be able to leave 99% of the details of what you're working on out. And that's really hard. And so the process for me is, tell me what the story is in one sentence. One sentence. And then once you've got that sentence, start thinking about how to tell something to make that sentence make sense. And so people say to me, are there stories that are too complicated to do on the radio? And the answer is, well, no, I think not. I mean, there are some that I prefer not to. I still don't understand quantum physics, and I do it all the time, and I'm giving up on it. Just totally don't understand it, but I know it's important. And I try to explain it the best I can, but it's one of those things where the details are beyond a lot of people. But I know why it's important, and I know why people are working on it. I know what they have hope it will be able to do. And so you have to use that and give up the fact that you're never actually going to tell them how a quantum computer is going to work. And you're probably not even going to be able to tell them the problems that a quantum computer is going to be exquisitely good at solving, because those are abstract. But you can talk about the fact that there are problems that are so impossibly complex that a modern computer could never tackle them. And there are problems with modern computers in terms of finite limits about how fast they can operate, which means that we're going to need to go into another domain. And the quantum computing domain seems to offer opportunities to build machines that can operate multiply faster, orders of magnitude faster than anything we can conceive of today. How does it work? I never said that, right? But you can interest people in the subject by not trying to teach it to them, but to explain it to them. That's part one. Part two is, think of everything as a story, and the easiest way to tell a story is once upon a time. And I find that almost every story when I can't think of how to tell a story, I can always go back to once upon a time, because once upon a time, we lived in a world where we didn't understand this. And then somebody came along and he said, you know, I don't understand this, but I think I can explain it if I do this experiment. So he does this experiment, and lo and behold, he gets an answer, and now he understands this a little better, but it's raised another question, but that's tomorrow's story, right? Once upon a time is a great storytelling tool. And I have one final, since I've got the soapbox and the mic is on, I have one final thing which I think is really important for scientists to remember, especially in the talking to the public and talking to the media. Scientists like to say, it's not about me, it's about my work. And I say, no, I'm sorry, it's about you, because you're a person, and people like stories about people. And when you become a person, then they're interested to hear your story. And if you're just going to fall back on the facts, I mean, that's fine, but you have to assume that they're already interested in the facts. And I realize that I have to start with, nobody's interested. That's my premise. Nobody's interested in, I mean, there are some things that everybody wants to know, you know, how do I lose weight? But you don't have to explain why that's interesting to people. But the rest of everything is mostly, you don't even know why this is interesting until I tell you.
We'll take another short break. This is Eastern Standard. We're speaking with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. We will be right back. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations, and it is the annual day sponsorship edition of Eastern Standard. I'm John Hingsbergen with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. We are at the Lyric Theater Arts and Cultural Center in Lexington, and Joe Palca is here interacting with listeners who have contributed to WEKU. And we want to turn our attention for a few minutes to a subject that I know you have spent a lot of time on, Joe, which is space exploration. While we invite members of our audience to come forward with questions that may take us in other directions, but let's take just a few minutes to talk about the exciting areas, the exciting stories in the field of space exploration. For one, some of us grew up in the generation of President Kennedy announcing that we choose to go to the moon, and we went there.
Yep.
We went there a number of times. We built a space shuttle, and we had some tragedies around the use of the space shuttle. And it seems like our space program has been really stuck in neutral, going nowhere, at least from the point of view of many of us laypersons outside of the world of science. What is happening in the field of space exploration?
Well, have you ever seen a picture taken by the Hubble Space Telescope?
Of course.
Right. So have you ever seen a picture of the surface of Mars?
Beautiful.
Right. So have you ever seen a picture of Pluto, this planet that used to be?
Not sure if I've seen one of those.
Right. Well, my point about saying that is that There's a part of the space program that seems to be stuck in neutral, which is the human exploration of space. And after landing on the moon several times, the country lost its appetite for that expense, which was enormous. And the replacement was really expensive, and it just didn't thrill people the same way, because once you've been to low Earth orbit, I don't know if you've seen, but you go around and around and around and around. And the stuff they do and the things they're doing are amazing. And I actually did a story a number of years ago about the science on the International Space Station, and there's some amazing stuff. But the most amazing stuff is for people who want to be in space. And that's a sort of a small population. So I argue that the space exploration, the reason it's a little bit uncertain now is not because of the human missions, but because NASA's had to make priorities so that a lot of space exploration, science exploration, has had to be cut back in order to afford this International Space Station and some other things. But there's the James Webb Space Telescope, first telescope ever named after an administrator. That's very exciting. There's the Juno mission to Jupiter, which is going to go in orbit on the 4th of July this year. There are a number of solar missions. There's a number of Earth-observing satellites. There's a Mars 2020 coming up. The European Space Agency has a bunch of interesting missions. So I think the robotic exploration of the space is potentially fascinating, and I think NASA misunderstood the public's appetite, they'd love to see a human being plant a flag in Mars, I get that, but people's interest in the Hubble Space Telescope and the pictures and the pictures from Mars, they've been enormous, enormous, and maybe even the most exciting part is that kids are finding them fascinating, and you can go, and this is the one thing, cool thing, I'll do an ad for NASA here. On the Juno spacecraft to Jupiter, there's something called JunoCam, which is actually a camera that was supposed to go on a Mars mission, and they decided they weren't going to put it on the Mars mission, so they stuck it on Juno. And the public will be able to vote on what to take a picture of with JunoCam. Oh, that's great PR. Whoever thought of that was really cooking that day.
What about the private enterprise approach, the fact that a lot of effort is now going into businesses that are developing, and we're talking about space tourism, are we not? Are these private companies going to leapfrog ahead of NASA, or have they already done so?
I'm not the best person to answer that question because I haven't been following the private companies as much. I think, SpaceX announced that it was going to send a capsule to Mars and launch it in 2018. Whew, that's ambitious. But, you know, maybe that's where the next breakthrough in terms of ambition is going to come from. Because, you know, it's very hard. You can be the president, you can be the head of NASA, you can be whatever, and say, this is what I want to do, but then you have to convince Congress that that's what you want to do and you're going to get paid for it, and that's not always so easy. So I salute the people who say, I'm going to do this because this really is something I think is important.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU station's NPR science correspondent. Joe Palka is with us for the WEKU Day Sponsorship event at the Lyric Theater in Lexington. We have an audience of WEKU listeners, supporters, actually, in attendance on this Thursday evening in May. And the stepping to the microphone is Roz Heise.
Thank you so much for being here, Joe. Really, really appreciate it. I am not a scientist, unlike so many of the folks here, but my question deals with global warming and how you respond to the deniers in our universe these days.
Yeah. I have an easy answer to that, which I'll freely admit is a cop-out. And the easy answer is that I'm a science correspondent. And people say, well, what about the people who say climate change isn't happening or it's not noticeable? And I say, well, happily, I'm a science correspondent, and the people who are saying that are not scientists, so I typically don't talk to them. Now, that's the cop-out answer. The reality is that there is a controversy, I know. To me, and I say this quite honestly, I am not satisfied myself that scientists have done a very good job of articulating what is enough of a response by society. I mean, they say, we have to do something. Okay, I get that. But they you know, does that mean no internal combustion engines? Or does it mean some internal combustion engines? No international travel on aircraft or some? In other words, it's a societal question how much of a response you want to make, but it's also partly a scientific one of how much of a response is enough. I mean, maybe it's too late. Maybe we should just enjoy the time we have and not worry about it. I think those are difficult questions to answer, but so that's where I'm sympathetic to the people. I don't understand people who say it's not happening. I mean, that to me is just, you know, put your head in the sand. But the people who say, I'm not sure how big of a change it's going to be or how much we can prevent, or what I like is that nobody's saying we don't have to deal with it. I was asked to do the scientific stands of the presidential candidates in the McCain-Obama campaign, and so I called, I tried to find out what Sarah Palin's attitude was. Well, but you guys are, it's, well, so I called a bunch of scientists who were environment in the University of Alaska, and they said Sarah Palin was the first governor of Alaska to set up an emergency committee to deal with climate change effect on Alaska. What? Now, at least she wasn't saying it's not happening. She can still say, I don't know what's causing it. But there's a reality. The people who have to deal with the consequences of climate change, they're not arguing about it. The military isn't asking itself, should we, you know, change the way we build our ships or the fuel we use? They're not doing that. They've already moved on from that. So it seems that there's another set of people who haven't. I have one other thing that I think has happened. When I'm old enough to have been a reporter, when somebody would publish a science study about the link between smoking and cancer, and then we'd all trot off to the Tobacco Institute and get the other side. And I think the other side is going to go away. Because when the Attorney General in New York State filed suit against ExxonMobil saying, you haven't warned your shareholders about the possible consequences to your business of global climate change, ExxonMobil didn't say, oh, it's not happening. They said, oh, yeah, we've been telling them since 2009 this is a major problem. And I think there's a parallel there. I think that the people who actually have to deal with this problem, they're going to have the same answer, was people want to drive their cars, what are we going to tell them? It's just like the tobacco company said, everybody knows, they went from one day saying, we're not sure tobacco's bad to you, for the next day saying, it's a personal choice. You get to decide whether you want to use it. Everybody knows it's bad for you. So the same thing is going to happen, I think. This is me. This is an opinion. And it's not NPR's opinion. I'm Joe Palca. But it does seem to me there's a parallel that at some point people are going to say, look, we have to decide. You know, people want to buy these big cars. Why is it up to us to tell them not to?
This is Eastern Standard. Joe Palca, NPR science correspondent, is our guest for the WEKU Day Sponsor event at the Lyric Theater in Lexington, Kentucky. And our next caller walking to the microphone is Richard. Hello, Richard.
Hello. I also work as a scientist, but I'm interested in public affairs, and Roz stole some of my thunder. My question is going to be about human-caused climate disruption. I do have a complaint with the way some people cover it, and it's probably the news side rather than the science side. This idea you just alluded to, that, you know, that we have to have a debate, we have to have a balanced discussion, and when you have a real scientific consensus, which I believe we have, on there's a human role on climate disruption, they find one of the few scientists who disagree, it really confuses the public. How do we, is there a way to help the public understand what is meant by a scientific consensus? And I'll also say we're in a state where we have numerous politicians that are climate change deniers. It's a real issue here. And we have a public that's very confused. You guys do a great job.
Well, Richard, we should point out that, Joe, we're also in the state that is home to the life-size replica of Noah's Ark opening this summer.
I think we could go on and on about what the public understands about science in this state. I mean, we got a problem.
So there's a question. I've been thinking a lot about this because this question comes up all the time, and I got into journalism because I said public needs to understand about science so they can make informed decisions, and basically the idea was that it was the information deficit model, that if people had the information they would make a different decision, right? And I'm not confident any longer that I don't have another model. There's not another. I'm not allowed to do it any other way. That the news media and my sense of being a professional is, you say what the facts are. That doesn't mean going to both sides. And we can talk more about that. When there's 100 people saying one thing and one saying the other, you don't go to the one guy. I get that. But I'm not trying to persuade anybody. I'm trying to offer facts. And I'm not sure that offering facts is having the result that you would like it to have. So if everybody in the state of Kentucky listened to WEKU and heard it and understood it and appreciated it, would they all change their minds and come along to think the way you do? I don't think so. Because I think I don't understand this. I'm a psychologist, and that's why I'm glad I'm not a psychologist anymore by training. You know, I'm a psychologist. I don't understand. We all make decisions based on fears and assumptions and belief systems and what have you. But I don't understand why facts seem to trouble people. And I don't have an answer for that. But I don't believe that there's anything that WEKU could do differently beyond what they're doing, which is presenting the straight information in as clear and compelling way as they can. And if that isn't changing people's minds or doesn't help them make informed decisions, I mean, it helps them make informed decisions, I can only presume that some people, well, again, I have to be careful. I'm not telling people what to think. But I'm telling you that if people say to me there is no such thing as climate change and scientists are all wrong, my question is, well, how do you know? Prove it. And mostly, there's no proof that scientists are wrong. They're wrong on margins. Look, it goes back to, there was a debate when AIDS virus was first discovered about whether HIV was really the cause of AIDS. And for a while, it was a reasonable question. There were still unknowns about how these things worked and how the disease progressed. And then they learned more. And they learn more, and nobody goes on the air anymore and says, HIV, the virus that might cause AIDS, right? So it evolves, but during that evolution can be very uncomfortable.
Richard, thank you for your question. This is Eastern Standard. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca is here with us for a few more minutes. And Joe, I would like to pick up on the question of what really excites you about what you're reporting at this point? What are the major stories that either you are following or that you're hoping to follow, the things that really motivate you to get out of bed in the morning and to do your work?
Well, the lucky thing for me is that every story I'm working on is the most exciting story I've ever done. So I don't have that problem. I mean, every time I come in, whatever it is, I mean, I can tell you right now that I have sound that I've collected for a story on personal rapid transit. I find that very interesting. I have sound I've collected for, I think I mentioned Juno's arriving at Jupiter on the 4th of July. I think that's a fascinating story. Maybe you all know that there are people who think that Jupiter has a solid core of heavy metals. I thought it was gas, but who knew? You know, I mean, I'm happy to learn things. So I'm interested in that. I have a story coming out, I hope, next week, but soon, about immunotherapy for cancer. I get to tell it. So my first job out of college was working as a lab technician, but I wound up working for a guy named Jim Allison. And Jim Allison won the Lasker Prize, which is the top biomedical prize in America, last year, and many people think he's going to win the Nobel Prize this year or soon for discovering this new immunotherapy for cancer. And I've just had this really fascinating interview with him. You asked me what's important, and I don't know what's important, but I can tell you that there's so many things that are interesting that I can sit here all day, if we had all day, and tell you really interesting stories about things I've seen or research I've heard about, and want you to enjoy them the way I do. I think Dick Zare, who's a chemist at Stanford, said to me, he said, scientists like to share things, and I like to help them share. He said, would an artist paint a painting if nobody could ever see it? Or would a composer compose a symphony if nobody would ever hear it? And the answer is, well, maybe, I don't know. But the point is, scientists like to share. They like to tell people what they're doing, and I like to help. So.
Well, Joe Palca, as those interesting things happen, we'll be counting on you bringing them to us through our radios, through NPR, and the hundreds of stations across the country that carry Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and of course, stations such as the WEKU stations. Thank you for being here with us for our WEKU Day Sponsorship reception for visiting Central Kentucky. Eastern Standard is a production of WEKU. At Eastern Kentucky University, this week's program was produced by Andrew Moorhead with assistance from Adam Cooper. We want to thank our production team, our student producers, and we want to remind you that you can hear this program as a podcast. It will be posted online shortly after its initial broadcast, and it will be repeated on Sunday evening at 6 o'clock. For WEKU and Eastern Standard, I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks to all the WEKU Day sponsors who have supported WEKU.